in this evening's talk with the Metta Sutta. This is a translation of this short teaching of the Buddha, the Metta Sutta, a translation that was done by the monks from the Amaravati Monastery in England. Should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Of this evening's talk is Why Metta? Question, this question that certainly has some very obvious answers, as well as some answers that may not be so immediately obvious to us. And our response to this question, why metta, or why practice metta, may certainly bring to light many varieties of responses as the question emerges at various times throughout the years of our practice. So this evening I'd like to explore a few possibilities in response to this question, and in part through various stories, ancient stories, as well as some contemporary stories. And so I'm beginning with an old story. Buddha first taught metta to a group of 500 monks who went to a particular and a seemingly very congenial, very friendly, very comfortable forest for their 3-month rainy season retreat. This forest was adjacent to a village of very strong Dhamma supporters who offered to build 500 huts for the 500 monks to stay in during the rains retreat, and who were also very happy to keep the monks' alms bowls filled during this practice period. In other words, to keep feeding them. And so the monks moved in, and they began practicing Vipassana. It's said that the unseen beings, the forest devas that lived in this particular forest, became quite fearful of the monks and felt quite put out of what they considered to be their forest, their home. Once they realized that the monks weren't just visiting the forest for a day or two, but that they were going to be staying there for quite a long time. So these forest-dwelling beings began to create various frightening sounds, frightening sights, and to emit some very distasteful odors, hoping that this would make the monks leave their forest. Well, soon enough, the monks became quite afraid, developed a lot of fear, became quite terrified, which actually broke their samadhi, broke their concentration. And some of the monks even developed a fever and pain and dizziness in conjunction with the fear that they were experiencing. And all of them felt that it was impossible to continue practicing where they were. So they all got together and they went to where the Buddha was staying, and they related their story to the Buddha. And the Buddha responded in this way. He said, "My beloved monks, go back to exactly the same forest and practice your meditation there." Well, the monks responded to the Buddha's words by pleading, by begging him not to be sent back to that forest, and again saying it was impossible to practice there. And the Buddha's response to them was this: "Dear monks, because you went there to practice, you went there to practice meditation without a weapon of protection, it encouraged many distractions, many difficulties. This time, however, I will give you a true weapon of protection." And it said that it was at this point that the Buddha offered the metta teaching, and he offered the teaching to this particular group of monks. Out of their great respect for the Buddha, the monks didn't dare contradict what his wishes were. And so, armed with the metta teaching and the practice, the metta practice, they went back to that same forest. And for a while, continued to experience feelings of fear, feelings of anxiety, worry, while at the same time they very diligently and very virtuously practiced metta. And soon, there were no more fearful sights, no more fearful sounds. And whereas the devas, the forest-dwelling beings, had previously been quite hostile towards the monks, their anger, the devas' anger, and their resentment disappeared as well when they began to feel the monks' metta. And in fact, feelings of respect, feelings of welcome, and even a sense of reverence began to be the devas' experience, along with a sense of being connected, feeling connected, like as though with family, in relationship to the monks. And the inclination arose within these devas to provide an environment of safety, to protect the monks from the particular real dangers, we could say, that might be lurking in the forest, so that the monks could continue to practice peacefully. It said that all 500 monks at some point began again to practice Vipassana meditation, along with metta as their foundation. And it said because they were able to practice their meditation peacefully, that they all, every one of them, became arahants, fully enlightened beings, during that rainy season retreat. So the great strength of a heart, the great strength of a mind, protected through what the Buddha called a true weapon of protection, protected through the energy of metta, this capacity to stay present, to stay connected with a heart that's fearless, with a heart, with a mind that's free of ill will. And this capacity is called for again and again and again throughout our practice, throughout our life. Buddha spoke a lot about patience. He often used the word forbearance, to forbear, as a description of patience. I don't know what that word might be in Hebrew. Forbearance. Does anybody know? Say it out loud for some people. Okay. We'll talk a little bit about this word in English, but since you now know what it is in Hebrew, we can discuss it in a sense. So forbearance in this sense, in the sense that the Buddha was using it, is not the attitude of kind of putting up with something. It's not about putting up with it. It's not about kind of toughing it out, being tough and getting through it. It's not that kind of forbearance. It's not using it in that way. Both of these attitudes come out of a kind of hard-shelled stance within ourselves. Patience or forbearance in the Dhamma sense, in the way the Buddha talks about it, is about the qualities of acceptance, and the quality of softness, and the quality of receptivity. This patience. And these qualities actually bringing us to abide in our life, which includes, of course, our meditation practice, to abide in a way that allows us to approach and to open to really be fully present with each moment, with a true openness, with respect, with humility, honoring ourselves, honoring others, honoring the moment, no matter what's coming to us, no matter what's happening inwardly or around us. Whatever we're facing in our mind, whatever we're facing in our body, and whatever we're facing outside of around us. So to forbear in this sense, it's a very clear, very strong place. Metta is a powerful way of introducing our heart, introducing our mind to patience. A clear way towards cultivating the strength that's inherent in a patient, loving heart. And really coming to know in a very deep experiential way that this is an advantage, that this is really a great advantage, a great benefit in one's life. Quite a number of years ago now, I was the resident teacher for the staff at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And each week we would have a Dhamma program, a meeting, and it would be on some Dhamma topic, some particular topic. So over a period of a few weeks, our topic was patience. We explored patience. And I asked the staff of the meditation center, what was your experience of patience? What is your experience of patience? And these are some of the things that they spoke about, that they shared. Somebody said, patience feels like body-mind calm, quietude, serenity. Someone else said, smoothness. Someone else offered, patience feels like persevering, openness, peace. Someone said patience feels like friendliness. Another person said okayness, satisfactoriness, ease. Another person said that for them, patience is the highest form of devotion. A term, an experience that one person described as patience was hastening slowly. In other words, getting there slowly. So not hurrying, but getting there. And then I asked the staff at the meditation center, what does impatience feel like? What's that experience? Someone said war. Restlessness, edginess, sometimes anger, heat, agitation, wanting, irritation, uneasiness. Somebody said not being able to stand it, not being able to bear it. Another person said unfriendliness. All of these that we all know, both the experiences of impatience and the experiences of patience. Probably familiar, or much of it, to each of us. The quality of patience, we could say that it implies faith. Not a blind faith, but a wise faith, a faith that's based in experience. The kind of faith that says, we'll see. We'll see how it is. We'll see. We could say that in response to everything, because we don't really know what's going to happen. That's patience. We'll see. With no anxious energy in it. We'll see. I don't know. And also, patience implies a faith that in ourselves, in that we're doing our best, if we're really patient. The writer Rainier Maria Rilke talked about patience in a very beautiful way, and I'd like to read a little bit of his words about this quality. Measuring with time. No year matters, and 10 years are nothing. Being an artist means not reckoning, not counting, and meditation is really an art, if you haven't already discovered that for yourself. Being an artist means not reckoning and counting, but ripening, like the tree, which doesn't force its sap and stands confident in the storms of spring, without the fear that after them may come no summer. It does come, but it comes only to the patient, who are there as though eternity lay before them, so unconcernedly still and wide. And then he says, I learn it daily, and sometimes with pain, to which I am grateful. Patience is everything, he says. So as we cultivate metta and live more patiently, as we are more and more still and wide, and at the same time determined, it's inevitable that there will be an increase of joy, that there will be more peace, that fearlessness will increase, develop, that unconditional acceptance, kind-heartedness will grow, and a growing and greater capacity to live a beneficial and compassionate life will happen. It's actually inevitable if we keep practicing. Cultivation of metta, we're inviting the opening, the expansion of the heart, the expansion of the mind. And using the metaphor of breath, metta is like the experience of breath moving through us. It's intangible. It's boundless. It's empty. Where from? Where to? And yet it's a very powerful energy that moves within us and from us. From the Buddha speaks of metta as non-ill will. So the absence of ill will in relationship to ourself, our body, our mind, however they're acting from moment to moment, and an absence of ill will towards others. So no aversion. So it was defined sometimes by the Buddha in the negative, we could say. No ill will, no aversion is metta. So for instance, no comparing ourselves in relationship to others. No comparison, no conceit, no pride, no self-depreciation, no self-judgment. No judgment, no depreciation of others. The absence of ill will. And even right here in this retreat, how often might we look at and think about maybe the person next to us, in front of us, across the room from us, and think, how much better their practice is than mine. I'm not any good, not practicing well. Look at them. They're really good. They're so peaceful. Or the opposite. I'm great. Just no sleepiness, no movement, so still, so concentrated, so open. And that person on the other side of the room, they're snorting. They're even snoring sometimes. Moving. Frowning. Their practice, no good at all. Mine's great. Metta, obviously. We're creating a separation. Me and whoever that other person is. The heart, the mind is contracted. We're continuing to create and sustain a separate self. With the comparing mind, there's actually a contraction. We contract. Again, we might ask the question, that same question, Why metta? It was amazing and very important for me, and that I did mention in last evening's Dharma talk, was when I began to discover that metta doesn't necessarily depend on initially liking someone or approving of them. With this heart of metta, we're able to connect with beings beneath with that which with we may not, what we may not agree with. We may be able to connect with beings who act in ways that we may not condone. Metta is acceptance on a very deep universal level. And as I mentioned, there aren't any favorites with metta. No favoring one over the other. So it's not divisive. Metta is a unifying energy. It brings things together. From this perspective, from this way of understanding metta, at least intellectually, we can begin to understand that it's impersonal. In its nature, it's impersonal. And that no conditions have to be met for metta to manifest. So, just for a moment reflecting on this, if there were no metta in this world, the world would have actually flown apart. The world would have actually broken apart long ago. There have been periods throughout our human history, and up until this very moment, when there's been more or less metta manifesting in this world. More peaceful times, times of relative ease in the world, and periods when the world has been increasingly unsettled. More violent times. This very powerful energy of goodwill is the energy that unifies, the energy that brings things together. It's so essential, so necessary, and so relevant here in Israel. Writer Dina Metzger, who some of you may be aware of or familiar with, she had something to say about this. She said, "There are those who set fire to the world. We are in danger. There's no time to go slowly. There's no time not to love." So maybe a surprising ending. There's no time to go slowly. There's no time not to love. And of course, the Buddha said it perfectly. He said, "Hatred can never cease by hatred. Only through love alone can healing happen. This is a universal law." Metta is the ground, the basis, the impetus for our thoughts, our words, our actions. If this is what our thoughts and words and actions spring from. If our motivations and our intentions spring from the heart of metta, the karma that's created will be wholesome, healing, both personally and in ways beyond our small lives, and even in ways that we will never, never know. Helpful to spend a few moments exploring some of the expectations that we might think the experience of metta is supposed to be. I think that many people expect metta to be a feeling, a familiar feeling. So we look for some familiar felt sense. And of course, our looking, our expectation is based on something that we already know, something we're familiar with. It's pretty difficult, actually impossible, to expect or look for something that we don't know, to look for something that maybe we've never experienced, or to look for something that maybe we have experienced but didn't label as unconditional loving kindness, didn't recognize as unconditional friendship, didn't recognize as metta. Sometimes metta does and can manifest as a familiar felt sense. But we can actually get caught in that. We can get stuck in expecting this. And it's very limiting. And as I've already mentioned, metta is not sentimental. It's not at all romantic. These are both totally conditional experiences. And metta isn't even necessarily always a particularly juicy feeling. Heart is the mind that's free from ill will, that's free from greed, fear, hatred, anger, in any given moment, is the mind of stillness, the heart of peacefulness. It's in this absence of greed, in the absence of aversion, it's in the abiding stillness, in the abiding peace, that metta arises. And it may or may not be a feeling that we think of and are familiar with as love. We learn a great strength in our capacity to connect with ourselves and to connect with others. Connecting directly, clearly, patiently, fearlessly, with a mind, with a heart that's free of ill will. So this unfettered, unconditional connection is what we could call metta. And as many of you are discovering, it's not really so easy. There are so many layers of conditioning that need to be seen, that need to be seen through, and then to let go of as our practice unfolds. Personally, I found over the years that the qualities of honesty and humility are essential, really essential, if practice is to continue to unfold and to reap its very amazing benefits. There's a very beautiful story in the Anguttara Nikaya, a collection of the Buddha's teachings. It's the story of Sariputta's lion's roar. And this talks about this in a very beautiful way, these particular qualities of honesty and humility and metta. Sariputta was one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, and he was considered by the Buddha to be foremost in terms of discernment and wisdom next to the Buddha. This story takes place just after the completion of the three-month rains retreat, the rainy season retreat. And the monks were beginning to disperse, get themselves ready and to disperse to various duties and various responsibilities in other places. And so this is the sutta. If you're not familiar with the suttas, there's a lot of repetition. And for good reason. Because people, as I mentioned around the chanting, most people didn't read and write. And so the teachings were transmitted orally and repeated and repeated and repeated. So they were learned. So there's a Buddha, and there's a somewhat of a tradition of repeating things three times. I cut out a lot of that in this, but there's still some repetition. Just so you get a flavor of the suttas. On one occasion, the Blessed One, as the Buddha was called in the suttas quite often, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove at Anathapindika's monastery. At that time, the Venerable Sariputta approached the Blessed One. Having paid homage to the Blessed One, he sat down to one side and said to him, "I have now completed the rains retreat at Savatthi, and I wish to leave on a country journey." And the Buddha replied, "Sariputta, you may go whenever you're ready." The Venerable Sariputta rose from his seat and bowed to the Buddha, and keeping him to his right, departed. Soon after the Venerable Sariputta had left, one monk spoke to the Buddha, and he said, "The Venerable Sariputta hit me and has left on his journey without an apology." Right away, the Blessed One called another monk and said, "Go, monk, and call the Venerable Sariputta, saying, 'The Master calls you, Sariputta.'" So the monk did as he was asked to, and the Venerable Sariputta responded, saying, "Yes, friend." And then the Venerable Mahamoggallana, another of the close disciples of the Buddha, and the Venerable Ananda, another close disciple, taking the keys, went around to all of the monks' lodgings and said, "Come, come, reverend sirs, for today the Venerable Sariputta will utter his lion's roar in the presence of the Blessed One." The Venerable Sariputta approached the Buddha, and after bowing to him, sat down to one side. And when he was seated, the Buddha said, "One of your fellow monks here has complained that you hit him and left on your journey without an apology." And the Venerable Sariputta responded, "I remember the discourse," talking to the Buddha, "I remember the discourse that you gave 12 years ago to Bhikkhu Rahula." Rahula was the Buddha's son. "When he was 18 years old, you taught him to contemplate the nature of earth, water, fire, and air in order to nourish and develop the virtues of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And although your teaching was directed towards Rahula, I also learned from it. I have practiced and observed that teaching." And he called the Buddha Lord, so I'll read it just the way it is in the sutta. Excuse me. "Lord, I have practiced mindfulness and loving kindness. One who does not practice mindfulness of the body in the body, of the actions of the body in the actions of the body, and is not present, may well hit a fellow monk and leave without an apology. I have practiced like the earth, whether people throw clean substances such as flowers, perfume, or milk upon the earth, or foul, unclean substances like dung, urine, spittle, pus, and blood. Yet for all that, the earth has no revulsion, no loathing, no disgust towards it. Even so, Lord, do I dwell with a heart that is like the earth, vast, exalted, and measureless, without hostility and without ill will. I have practiced mindfulness and loving kindness. One who does not practice mindfulness of the body in the body and is not present may well hit a fellow monk and leave without an apology. But it is not my way to be rude to a fellow monk and hit him and walk on without apologizing. I have practiced like water, People use water to wash things clean and unclean, things soiled with dung, urine, spittle, pus, and blood. And yet for all that, the water has no revulsion, no loathing or disgust towards it. Even so, Lord, do I dwell with a heart that is like water, vast, exalted, and measureless, without hostility and without ill will. A monk who does not practice mindfulness, who does not practice becoming like water, might hit a fellow monk and go on his way without saying, "I'm sorry. I am not such a monk. Lord, I have practiced to be more like fire." Fire burns things pure and impure, the beautiful as well as the distasteful. And yet for all that, the fire has no revulsion, loathing, or disgust towards it. Even so, Lord, do I dwell with a heart like fire, vast, exalted, and measureless, without hostility, without ill will. A monk who does not practice mindfulness of seeing, hearing, thinking might hit a fellow monk and go on without apologizing. Lord, I am not such a monk. I have practiced like the air. The air blows over things clean and unclean and carries all smells, pleasing and unpleasing. And yet for all that, the air has no revulsion, no loathing, no disgust towards it. Even so, Lord, do I dwell with a heart that is like air, vast, exalted, and measureless, without hostility and without ill will. I have practiced mindfulness of the body in the body, the movements of the body in the movement of the body, the positions in the body in the positions of the body, the feelings in the feelings, the mind in the mind. One who does not practice mindfulness might hit a fellow monk and go on without apologizing, "I am not such a monk." Lord, I dwell with a heart that is humble, vast, exalted, and measureless, without hostility and without ill will. I have practiced and learned every day. A monk who does not practice loving kindness and mindfulness might hit a fellow monk and go on without apologizing, "I am not such a monk." Sariputta continued to deliver his lion's roar. And at one point, the accusing monk rose from his seat and arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, and with his head on the ground, bowed to the feet of the Buddha, saying, "Lord, I committed an offense and was so foolish, jealous, angry, and unskillful, I accused the Venerable Sariputta falsely, wrongly, untruthfully. Let the Blessed One and the Sangha accept my admission of the offense and pardon me, and I shall practice restraint in the future." And the Buddha responded to this monk, "Truly, monk, you committed an offense when you were so foolish, so jealous, angry, and unskillful, that you accuse Sariputta falsely, wrongly, and untruthfully. But as you have recognized your offense and made amends, we pardon you. It is a sign of growth when one recognizes one's offenses, makes amends, and in the future practices restraint." And then the Buddha turned to the Venerable Sariputta, and he said, "Forgive this foolish man, Sariputta, before his head splits into 7 pieces on this very spot." And Sariputta said, "I shall forgive him. If this revered monk would also ask for my pardon, as I may not have been skillful enough, and may have created some misunderstanding, may he too forgive me." And then Sariputta and the accusing monk bowed 3 times to each other and reconciled. If there are points along the way of our practice where the specific direction of unconditional loving kindness needs to be turned around towards ourselves, as many of you know. And at times it may not be so easy to do this, so not so easy to accept doing this once we begin to do it, because of what may be very strong conditioning that told us maybe we're unworthy, or maybe we're unlovable, or we're not good enough, or not enough, or that it's selfish to love ourselves. And we may have taken in, unconsciously, carried on, and become very identified with these attitudes towards ourselves. This relationship to ourselves, as though this is who we are. This conditioning that comes from some karma that's been moving maybe through our family, maybe through our culture, maybe for years and years, maybe for generations. At some point along the way of our practice, we wake up to knowing that we have a choice. This aspect of waking up sometimes comes to us through some strong suffering, strong dukkha. Or it may come through some degree of understanding, some insight that our predicament is actually unnecessary. I think it's very helpful at times to ask yourself, is this necessary? Is this really necessary? Is this true? It's a good question to ask yourself sometimes. Up to knowing that we don't have to be run by any particular karmic predicament. We have a choice. We have a choice to step out, to step off the wheel, the karmic wheel, and not keep running around the wheel and running around the wheel like a rat or a gerbil. We have these little pets, or put them in a cage and they just run around and around and around. We can step off the wheel. We have a choice. We wake up to the fact that we can change our mind. And that, in fact, our mind is changing through our practice. Our practice directs us towards being selfish in the right way. It seems to take a tremendous amount of honesty and humility to truly practice. And it sometimes takes a lot of metta energy directed towards ourselves to open to be with, and to clearly, really clearly see things as they are. And as we've already begun to discover, metta doesn't cover over anger. It doesn't cover over fear or jealousy or irritation. Metta changes our mind. Practice is about making the choice to transform our heart, to transform our mind, so that we embody love. And I think it's a courageous choice. It actually opens the heart to not turn away, to not distract ourselves, to not pretend anything, but to just stay still, to be here, to be present in relationship with what is. It's a choice to see and to experience things just as they are, with the very natural strength that comes from the expanding capacity of our heart. I'm going to stop for a minute and ask everybody who's lying down to please sit up. It creates a very difficult energy for everybody in the room if you're lying down. Thank you. Mid-1990s, over a consecutive 2-year period, I taught in Poland. The first year I taught for 2 months, and the second year I taught for a month. And one of the students who attended stayed for the whole 2 months of this first year. He was a man in his early 40s, and he was a very successful big city businessman in Warsaw. And this man had been diligently practicing Zen and karate for 10 years before he came to this retreat, which was a metta vipassana retreat. He'd grown up in a home environment with a very ill-tempered father and a very ill-tempered uncle. And as he said, living with his heart burning with fear through much of his childhood. And with the fear still present in his adult life. But obvious to him in his adult life was that he'd learned and taken on some of the habits, some of the thoughts, some of the actions and words of this ill temper that he'd grown up with his father and his uncle. And he described himself to me as a man of heavy emotions, which was becoming more and more uncomfortable to him as his practice developed and as his practice deepened. Very unlike his father and his uncle, he'd actually begun to see himself more and more clearly through his martial arts practice and through his interest in Buddhism and meditation. In being introduced to the metta teachings and the practices, he found himself very, very interested, very attracted to these teachings and practices. And at some point during our 2-month practice period, he decided to take on the phrase, "May I love myself completely, just as I am in this present moment." And he decided to take this practice on, this phrase on as his practice for the whole next year after he returned to Warsaw. Because of his 10 years of Zen training, he changed the phrase just slightly. He created a koan. If some of you know, a koan is a question in Zen that cannot be answered by any logical or linear way. It's a question that kind of shifts the mind in a certain way. So he created a koan out of this phrase by changing one word. Instead of saying "may I," he said "can I." Can I love myself completely, just as I am in this present moment? And he silently said this koan over and over and over during his formal sitting practice each day at home after he returned home. And in situations at work with his employees, he said it at home in relationship to his family. And he said that he said it whenever he felt angry, whenever he felt enraged, which happened fairly often for him. He said that often he would remember to stop and be still for just a few seconds, and then silently repeat the koan to himself in the midst of anger. And he said even when this would happen in the midst of anger, he said more often as the year went on, and he remembered to do this, he could do it when the feelings of anger just started to come up, before they actually blew up. And as they started to arise, he would say, "Can I accept myself, love myself, etc." And he said that he found that the anger would dissolve very quickly when he would be able to do this before the anger really blossomed fully. The next year, he came back to the month-long retreat that I taught there at this center in Poland. And there had been an enormous transformation in this man. Quite a huge change. And, of course, that he was very happy about. And I think his employees were probably very happy about it. And his family was probably also very happy about it. And he certainly was a much happier human being. I mentioned last evening, and he's a good example of the story. Our human heart is naturally, intuitively loving, intuitively, naturally caring. That's what drove him to do this practice, that natural caring place in him. So from this perspective, our practice isn't about working to get something, to attain something, but really rather about allowing the mind, allowing the heart, through our practice, to be loving kindness itself. So from this perspective, we can turn right around and face ourselves, and holding this question in awareness, the question being, who loves? Who loves? There is metta. It's not me. It's not mine. It's not who I am. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to no one. It's, as Krishnamurti said, like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, and it's inexhaustible. When we persevere with our practice, there's a deepening of self-confidence, self-respect, patience, and a very powerful, gentle, powerful strength, and a growing and more pervasive selflessness. All of this manifesting and moving towards maturity as we continue with our practice. Our capacity expands to meet all the many, many changing facets of life and the worldly winds, as they're called, which I mentioned last night, the 8 worldly winds, the wind of praise and blame, the worldly winds of gain and loss. Pleasure, of pain, of fame and disrepute, or a good reputation, bad reputation. The 8 worldly winds, we are able to meet them with wisdom and sensitivity as our practice develops. In closing the talk, I'd like to share a story. A story about a young Native American woman whose name was Sue Ann Marie Big Crow. I think I may have told this story last time. It was years ago, but it's a good story, even if you've heard it before. She was born Native American, young, born on the Pine Ridge Reservation on March 15th, 1974. And she grew up with her sisters on the reservation in her mother's three-bedroom house. Sue Ann's mother, whose name was Chick Big Crow, was known to be quite a strict mother. Her daughters always had to be in the house when the streetlights went on. And the only after-school activities that she allowed them to take place in were chaperoned or structured kinds of activities. No unsupervised activities, and then later on, as they became teenagers, no cruising around in cars was allowed. So Anne said that she and her sisters had to come up with their own fun because their mother wouldn't allow them to socialize outside of school. So Anne's mother, Chick Big Crow, was quite strongly anti-drug and anti-alcohol. And she belonged to what was a very small, and probably still is, a very small but very strong minority on the reservation. Not very many people take that stance outwardly, because there's so much alcohol and drug use on many reservations. When Sue Ann was 9 years old, she was staying with her godmother on New Year's Eve, and the woman's teenage son came home drunk and shot himself in the chest. And the woman was so distraught she wasn't able to do anything, the boy's mother. So Sue Ann, at 9 years old, called the ambulance, called the police, and took care of her godmother until some other grown-ups arrived. And maybe because of this particular incident, Sue Ann herself became very opposed to drugs and alcohol. And she would give talks on the subject to school groups and traveled around to other schools and conventions of like-minded teenagers. A family named Rob Bradford, who was a former teacher and coach, basketball coach at the school, said that wondered at some point, actually, if Sue Ann's advocacy, her pressure about all this and her talking about it wasn't risky because of so much of the prominence of alcohol and drug use on the reservation. And she was very outspoken about it. And he came to understand that, and as he said, Sue Ann didn't respond to peer pressure. Sue Ann was peer pressure. She was the backbone of every group that she was in. And she was way wiser than her years, he said. He said that by Sue Ann coming out against drinking, that she saved a lot of young people's lives. And he said that she had quite an effect on him as well. He said it dawned on him at one point that if a 16-year-old girl could have the guts in the situation that she lived in to say the things that she said, that maybe adults should listen also. And he said that he stopped drinking himself. Only as Sue Ann's mother wouldn't allow her daughters to participate in certain activities, she strongly encouraged them to participate in sports. And so at one time, all the sisters did, the girls did them all. They cross country, running and track, volleyball, cheerleading, basketball, baseball. When Sue Ann was in the fifth grade, she heard somewhere that to improve your basketball dribbling, that you should bounce a basketball 1,000 times every day with each hand. So 2,000 times a day. And so she performed this exercise every day faithfully out on the back little patio cement floor of their backyard, which her mother and her sisters got very tired of. And so for something else to do, Sue Ann would shoot layup shots up against the drain pipe along the house until it fell off the roof and had to be repaired. And as you can imagine, this young girl, when she did play basketball games, she used to get a lot of fouls called on her because she was used to playing quite a strong game, and she would just kind of go and do whatever she thought she should do. In one game with another team, the Red team from Red Cloud, Sue Ann, it said that Sue Ann scored 31 points herself. So just to give you a picture of this young person. Some people who live in cities and towns near Indian reservations treat their Indian neighbors decently, but some don't. Some people in South Dakota hate Indians and hate them unapologetically and will tell you why. And in their voices you can hear a particular American meanness that's centuries old. When the teams from the Pine Ridge Reservation would play non-Indian teams, sometimes the question of race was there. Of Pine Ridge was a visiting team. Usually their hosts were courteous, and the players and the fans had a good time. But the Pine Ridge coaches knew that occasionally at away games, that their kids would be insulted by the fans from the other team, and that they would feel very unwelcome, and that the host gym would be quite dense with hostility, and the referees would call a lot of fouls on the Indian players every chance they get. And sometimes then a game between Indian and non-Indians, the difference in race would become a very important and very distracting part of the event. And one place this regularly happened was in a place called Leeds, South Dakota. In the fall of 1988, the Pine Ridge Lady Thorpes, as the girls' team was called, went to Leeds to play a basketball game. And by that time, Sue Ann was a full member of the team. And she was a freshman. She was only 14 years old. Getting ready in the locker room, getting ready for the game, the Pine Ridge girls could hear this loud sound coming from the fans, the lead South Dakota fans out in the court area. And they were yelling. They were yelling these fake Indian war cries. The usual plan for the game, for the pregame warm-up, was that the visiting team would come out first. And they'd run onto the court in a line and run around the room, run around the court a few times, shoot a few baskets, and then go and sit at their bench on the side of the court. And then after that, the home team would come out and do the same thing. And then the game would begin. Usually the Pine Ridge team, the Lady Thorpes, lined up more or less according to height, which meant that the tallest, the senior, Donnie DeCorey in this case, who was the cousin of Sue Ann, was the tallest, and Donnie would go first. And as the team that evening was waiting in the hallway, leading from the locker room, the noise, the heckling, as it's called, I don't know what that word would be in. Mm-hmm. It got louder and louder. And some of the fans were waving food stamps, which is a reference in the United States to people that live on the reservation getting federal aid for food, getting stamps and getting federal aid so they could get some food because they were so poor. Other people the fans from the other team were yelling, "Where's the cheese?" as a joke, making a joke, which wasn't a nice joke, meaning that if Indians were lining up, they must be waiting to get some cheese from the government. And then the lead band joined in with fake Indian drumming and a fake Indian tune. Donnie DeCorey, the cousin of Sue Ann, looked out the door and then turned around and said to her teammates, "I can't handle this. I can't handle this." Then very quickly offered to go first in line, to go in her place, first in line. And she was so eager that Donnie, her cousin, became suspicious. And she said, "Don't embarrass us, Sue Ann." And Sue Ann said, "Don't worry, I won't embarrass you." And so Donnie gave her the ball, and Sue Ann was now first in line. And she came out running onto the court and dribbling the basketball expertly, because she'd been practicing 2,000 every day. And she ran straight up the center court. And the noise in the basketball in the gym was deafening, very loud by this time. She went right down the middle of the court and then suddenly stopped as soon as she got to the center. And her teammates were taken by surprise, and they all kind of bumped into each other because she stopped so suddenly. And the coach, who was at the back of the line, didn't know why they'd stopped. So Anne turned around to her cousin, Donnie, and tossed her the ball. And then she stepped into the circle, the jump ball circle in the center of the gym. And she faced the fans, the lead fans. And she unbuttoned her warm-up jacket, and she took it off, and then she just draped it over her shoulders, and she began to do the Lakota shawl dance. Sue Ann knew all of the traditional Indian dances, because as a young girl, she'd competed in many powwows. Powwows are a gathering, maybe you're familiar, that the Indians have every year. And they dance, and it's a competition. And she learned all the dances as a young girl. And the dance that she chose to do was a young woman's dance. Graceful, modest, and at the same time, quite a show-off dance. Her cousin, Donnie, said, "I couldn't believe it. She was powwowing like Get Down." And then Sue Ann started to sing. And she began to sing in Lakota. And she was swaying back and forth in the jump ball circle, doing the shawl dance, and using her warm-up jacket for a shawl, and singing in Lakota. And the crowd went completely silent, absolutely silent. And one of her teammates said, "All that stuff that the lead fans were yelling, it was like she reversed it somehow. In the sudden quiet, all they could hear was Sue Ann singing the Lakota song." And then she finished, and she dropped her jacket and took the ball from Donnie DeCorey and ran a lap all the way around the court, expertly dribbling, very fast. And then the audience began to cheer and began to applaud. And then she sprinted up to the basket, went up in the air, and put the ball right through the hoop. And the fans were just yelling and cheering at that point. And of course, the Pine Ridge team, the ladies' girls' team, went on to win the game. The person who transmitted this story said that he couldn't find any evidence of a single act anywhere that was as elegant and as generous and as transcendent as Sue Ann's dance at the center court in the gym in Leeds, South Dakota. And actually, I agree. And I think of this as Sue Ann's lion's roar. There's a tremendous fullness of energy and a confident way to walk along our human path when the feeling of unconditional loving kindness is strong. Metta develops a straightforwardness, and it clarifies our ability to express what we know to be true without fear, without anger, without hesitation. There's really a great difference between saying something or acting from a place of wisdom, from a place of a clear, complete, intuitive understanding based on our inner knowledge of its truth, rather than our words or our actions coming out in maybe a harsh way, from a place of fear, from a place of anger, from a place of pride. And the Buddha called this tremendous fullness of energy the lion's roar. He said that when he himself spoke, it was like the lion's roar in the jungle, because the power of his words was born out of loving care and great compassion. Parts of our practice often come as a surprise. You encounter a difficult situation, and do what seems to come naturally. And then after the fact, you realize that you handled the situation very differently from the way you used to. The natural, effortless expression of awareness, loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, true result, we could say. At the time, what you do seems perfectly natural. It's no big deal, you might say to yourself or to a friend. If someone asks you, how were you able to stay present and to do what was needed to be done in that situation? You say, well, it was no big deal. But it is a big deal. Because the natural expression of these qualities changes your life. It changes the lives of everyone that you encounter. And so let's just sit for a moment.